Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to the Above Politics Show. I'm Martin Bain, and we've got a returning guest today. We've got H.L. Quist back with us, who did an interview with us in January this year, talking about economics and finance, and we've touched on things like derivatives and Alan Greenspan. But Buster and I were talking off air. Welcome to the show, Buster.
Good morning. It's good morning here.
And it's afternoon for me, but such is the sort of the power of the internet that, you know, we can be having conversations throughout the world. One of the things I was very interested in, you and I were just talking off air a few minutes ago, and you sort of surprised me a little bit by the comment that you said there had been a coup d'etat in the States. And I'm sort of thinking, well, I hadn't noticed that one leadership style or one leadership had been replaced by another.
Well, I definitely think since our conversation in January, there's been a dramatic change in certainly the political structure and the economic structure in the United States. And by what I mean by a coup d'etat with this new administration is that not only has there been kind of a takeover in the government, people think, well, it's the Democrats and the liberals versus the conservatives, but it's more than that. This group, Obama, you know, the Chicago politics, I mean, these are radical left-wing people that he has brought into this organization or into the administration. And, of course, that's surfacing now through different shows and exposure of Acorn and this Van Jones and so forth, and playing clips of his speeches and so forth. People are just now beginning to get a view of what's really going on. But, you know, the other thing, too, is that there's been a takeover, a coup, in the Democratic Party. You remember last summer that, you know, Hillary was a shoo-in for the Democratic presidential nomination, and then suddenly this Obama comes out of nowhere, and he just slam dunks her. So what happened there was a takeover of really promoted by George Soros, who people in Europe will remember George Soros and breaking the Bank of England to the tune of $1 billion in a couple days when he shorted the pound. Well, he is the open society advocate that has really funded. He was the primary funding source for Obama and this group of left-wing radicals that now have taken over not only America, but they've taken over the Democratic Party.
And sort of, I'm sort of interested in how do you sort of get from George Soros, who is seen as probably an archetypal capitalist, someone who's made huge sums of money speculating on foreign currencies, how you square that with Barack Obama, who's definitely seen as a Democrat and probably a left-leaning Democrat. And then, you know, you almost have to mention the word socialist here, which I know in Europe we don't have a problem with, but in the States, you know, socialism seems to be this odd word that no one wants to mention. How you marry those two of George Soros, you know, the archetypal capitalist wanting to back Barack Obama, who was seen as probably on the left of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on here, Martin. I think that, you know, Soros being from Europe and now a U.S. citizen, he has a different view. I think that all of Europe and maybe even the people in the U.K., there is a resentment to the U.S. because they've been the bully on the block. You know, they've kind of dictated financially, particularly, the world scene. But Soros's view, and people should go to his website, you know, the Open Society. I mean, he wants to basically undermine and replace the U.S. Constitution, I mean, and the Bill of Rights. And, of course, that is now evident to a lot of people in America that this is not just the Liberal Party and the left side of the Democratic Party. This is much more deep than that, and the whole picture is that's emerging is much more fundamental. And they keep playing on Fox News, you know, that clip that 5 days before the election where Obama, to a screaming audience, says, in 5 days we're going to fundamentally change America. Well, most Americans didn't know what change was. They disliked and they resented what Wall Street and the perceived conservatives and Republicans had done to the financial markets. And change was very attractive, but now the population in the U.S. is beginning to find out, as evidenced by that march in on 9/12 in Washington, where over a million people attended that, people now have discovered what this change really is, and now there is a counter revolution to meet the this new administration.
So, what,
but the connection with Soros is that he's an opportunist from the financial markets, as he evidenced by what he accomplished in shorting the pound. He's shorting the U.S. dollar by demonizing and undermining the American form of government or in governance. Of course, he's short the U.S. dollar, and of course, it's plunged 17% against this foreign basket of currencies in the, you know, just this year alone. So, you know, he's got both a financial motive and he's got a political motive. And this is more, you know, I've kind of skipped the term socialism because, you know, this is beyond socialism. I mean, this is more fascist than it is anything where, you know, what people forget about Italy in the 1920s and the 1930s is that Mussolini appealed to big business because he made deals with big business. He said, you know, the profit incentive has to be there. Now, he wanted to control excess profits, which is exactly what the dialogue in Washington today is. And he favored small business and entrepreneurships and that form of capitalism. And that's what's made him so darn popular, is that he made deals with business, and basically the quid pro quo was that that opportunities would come along for big business, and they would thrive under his leadership. And people associated with the war effort and everything else, and expansionism and totalitarianism, but they've got to examine really what was going on in Italy during the 20s and the 30s before Hitler came onto the scene and made the deal with Mussolini. But that's where I see the connection, is they're all seeking absolute control, but they know that the Soviet model of and the communist model of state-owned enterprises and the manufacturing and the distribution and absolute control, they know that model doesn't work, so they've got to preserve that element of free enterprise or capitalism to make the economy go. And of course Soros is very good at that, but he is he wants to really change society, and it's pretty well stated on his website.
So does that mean that you and I'm going to use the word NWO, New World Order, does that mean that you by what George Soros and people similar to him who are trying to influence politicians, do you buy into the concept that there is a cabal of people who are trying to have a new world order, a single global government, maybe a single global economy, maybe a single global currency and a single global financial institution that runs everything?
I think that everything that's happening in here in the United States today is evidence of that. And people used to, you know, their eyes would glass over, you know, and they would just, you know, their eyes would roll and they would glass over when you mentioned New World Order a number of years ago. But you see, this, everything is fits the pattern, and that's where we're moving. And, you know, a lot of people think that Soros is outside the trilaterals or the Bilderbergers or, you know, all of these groups and the cabal. But you know, what the bankers have done in the past is that what they couldn't accomplish themselves, they had their appointed, you know, hitmen to do the job for them. And of course, what they see in Obama is a charismatic individual that can change society, change the markets, and they get what they want. The bankers get this, you know, control and this global one world government, and we're moving towards the, what do they call it, the Global Monetary Authority, which will be headquartered in Basel, and move the power, the financial power, from Wall Street and Washington to Europe and to the continent. I think that that is a huge change that is transforming right in front of our eyes right now.
Okay, so do you then, and one of the things I'm interested in, you were sort of talking about potentially deals being done with big business. Where do you see Barack Obama, you know, President Obama, pumping billions of dollars into Chrysler and GM fits into all of this one? Because, you know,
that's part of the fascist modus operandi of aligning itself with business. Obama would like to have direct interest in the banks by controlling, you know, by controlling compensation to a certain degree. They have control. But look at the automobile industry. But look at the big example of that is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. When you have government, of course, this was established under, you know, a long time ago, this quasi-government private partnership, in effect. That just leads to corruption. And that's what will happen in the automobile industry. That will happen in every industry that government has their hands into from a control standpoint. And the Fannie Mae, people in Europe won't remember Fannie Mae, but that was, there was supposedly a underlying federal guarantee of the Treasury guarantee of the Fannie Mae debt. And of course, 1994, it was revealed that this just tremendous corruption with Franklin Raines, the head of Fannie Mae, and cooking the books and making huge bonuses for himself. That's what happens. That's the end result of these partnerships with industry and the government. But what we're seeing now is that you know, recently in the news was this about face that Obama did on the missile system, the defense missile system that was going to be put in place to protect Poland and Czech and the countries in Eastern Europe. Then he did a complete about face. There was a clip on Fox News with that interview with Obama from September of 08, in which he said adamantly that this missile system would be put in place and that they would protect the Poles and the Czechs and so forth. And so what was the motivation that he did an about-face? Well, of course, he's placating the Russians, but also, which went unnoticed, was that Obama has made a deal with major U.S. corporations, GE and Walmart being the most prominent. In other words, if they would support his health care initiative and all of these, see his vision of America, they would get, the quid pro quo was that they would get deals, or they would get in a position to profit from deals. And the day after this missile deal is announced, it's also announced that GE is now in Russia setting up, they're working out deals with the Russian government, and also included Morgan Stanley and some other private equity firms and so forth. And I think that that's, you know, he's getting support from big industry, the largest employer in the United States, and using one of the largest companies, GE, which also controls NBC and of course CNBC and the media. So I think that they've got his army, his civilian defense force, and his army has already, in this short period of 9 months, has really taken control of America.
And I was just trying to sort of move on a little bit, and you spoke about healthcare as well, that, you know, how is that going to be funded? You know, because I know one of the issues of, you know, certainly on AboveTopSecret.com and talking to American friends is just potentially how much this may cost. And, you know, why would, you know, why would the people who want to control President Barack Obama here allow him to go and spend even more money? You know, he's put the US economy in hot for billions for the automotive industry. He's bailed out banks. Now he wants to potentially put in a sort of more uniform healthcare plan. How is he going to pay for all this one, or is he just going to continue to put so much debt in?
Yeah, he can't. You know, and if you go beyond the obvious, I mean, I am familiar with the health insurance, but it does need reform. But it's a little disingenuous to say that the plan, however it evolves, will not cost the taxpayers any money. It's going to be huge. It's just the same as Medicare. You know, they have these triggers in which they say if they exceed a certain limit, in other words, they'll cut benefits or they'll raise taxes. But you know, Congress has never done that. Once they put a plan in place. It's not unlike the UK system, you know, which was put in place during the war. You know, that the plan in the UK, as I understand it, was that after the war was over, they'd go to the private healthcare system, and of course it never did. And once it's all about incrementalism in politics, and particularly in America, is that all they want to do is get their foot in the door with some plan, and then they'll keep improving upon it each year until it's finally 100% single payer system. But it's going to cost a fortune, and then you've got to ask the obvious question: is the design of this, all of these stimulus packages, which is so unprecedented in American history, is the design to totally undermine the U.S. and its position financially in the world? And then when everything craters, then the new world government will come in and take control. I mean, you got to ask that question, because we'll never be able to retire $20 trillion in debt. The banks will never recover $2 trillion in consumer debt, in credit cards, when default rates now are 8 and 9%. I mean, it's just absurd if you take a step back and take a look at the big picture.
And who's potentially funding all of this? Well, I know I've heard talk of people saying that, you know, China have been buying up, you know, billions of dollars of U.S. debt. Is that where you believe? Is that where you believe the U.S. economy or the U.S. government is now being funded, because it's selling bonds to another government?
Well, they have $800 billion in treasury on the books. But you see, recently the Chinese just made a loan to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, of $50 billion to establish special drawing rights so that they can circumvent the U.S. dollar used in determining international trade. They are making deals with Brazil and other companies direct using these special drawing rights so that they don't make these deals denominated in U.S. dollars. So the big move with the G20, which is not published, is the fact that we're headed towards a new currency realignment. And when that is announced, we don't know, but I think that's the ultimate bailout of the, particularly the real estate and the mortgage market in the United States, which is just, is looking worse rather than getting better. And so I think this currency realignment is part of the new global monetary authority. I've seen press releases from Europe where the new currency is called the WOKU, which is for world currency, or some other type of scheme. But that's, I think, where we're headed.
And when do you think that's going to happen? Because I know people were talking about the Americano, which was going to be a currency that would span Canada, the U.S., potentially Mexico. And there was some, you know, I saw on a website on AboveTopSecret.com, allegedly pictures of the coin.
So I think that's been tabled, Martin. I think that this whole financial situation in the U.S. and the cratering of the CDO, the collateralized debt obligations, and the Wall Street, the whole fiasco a year ago, has changed all of the schemes. It's allowed them the opportunity to move forward towards the new world order a lot quicker than was anticipated.
So you would see the euro as a stepping stone towards potentially having a global currency.
Well, the information I'm getting is that there would be a basket of currencies. That's one solution where the euro, the Japanese yen, possibly the British pound, and the U.S. dollar, and maybe the Chinese yuan, would be in a basket of currencies so that it would avoid all this volatility and the devaluation and the desire or the objective to devalue currencies to be to have a trade advantage. So, you know, that's the scheme that I think the G20 is now considering, is a basket of currencies so that the dollar isn't the only and the single world reserve currency.
And I suppose it always begs the question is who's going to administer and control all of this one? And you spoke about, you know, potentially moving, you know, to a global federal reserve or a global Bank of England, for example. And you talked about it being based in Basel in Switzerland. Is that where you see that organization?
I think there's two competing entities. One is the International Monetary Fund located in Washington, which is proposed by the Russians and the Chinese, and the Chinese have moved, you know, with the $50 billion loan. They're funding IMF right now. And the other theory is that it'll be centered in the Bank of International Settlements in Basel. As you know, Basel now is the central banker's banker. You know, I mean, they're the ones that write the rules as to what we notice. What created the ultimate crash in the U.S. a year ago was Basel II, which required the banks to list their financials market to market, and that's when Lehman, you know, just went under because their portfolio of CMS or collateralized mortgage obligations was just, you know, all underwater, so they had a deficit net worth, and that's what created the collapse of Wall Street as we know it.
And I know we sort of, you know, round about the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman's. I'm interested, why didn't the U.S. government potentially save Lehman's?
Well, that's kind of an unwritten. I cover a lot of that in my books, in both books, particularly the last one. And I think that, you know, Paulson, Henry Paulson, this is my personal opinion now, Martin, but it kind of goes unsaid, you know, nobody's writing about it that I know of, is that Paulson was the former chairman of Goldman Sachs, who I affectionately refer to in my book as Goldman Sucks, because they suck all the profit out of the markets. But he was chairman. He became Secretary of Treasury and, of course, was the advocate and the dispersing agent for the TARP funds. And I think he was in a position to either determine the life or death of Lehman. I think it was an opportunity to get rid of a big competitor to Lehman by denying them any funding or availability of these government funds or taxpayer funds. The Fed didn't participate. The Treasury wouldn't participate through TARP, so they had nowhere to go, and they closed their doors. So I think personalities enter into it. I think that they saw an opportunity to get rid of a major competitor, and the aftermath of that is we see now that it could have been saved, and a lot of creditors would have gotten back a heck of a lot more money on the dollar than they're presently getting.
Wow. So one of the things I'm sort of interested in, I know we, you know, sort of what you see has been the financial highlights and lowlights, you know, in the last, you know, potentially six odd months since we spoke towards the end of January, early February. What would you see have been the highlights and lowlights or things that maybe haven't garnered the attention that you think they should have done?
Well, I think, you know, on the plus side, you've got to look to the recovery in the markets, and, you know, all the numbers here in the U.S. are the gross domestic product and, you know, the leading economic indicators, and you look at all these indices, and they are positive. The mortgage industry and the foreclosures and the consumer debt, of course, is the underlying problem that is not getting better. But the economy is improving, and my feeling is that they're kind of on a watch or standby that if the economy continues to improve, maybe they don't have to come up with the new currency alignment, and they'll wait, and they're just kind of a wait-and-see game and see what happens. But if it turns south and starts to turn negative, they're going to have to do something dramatic. And I think the currency alignment or realignment is one of the options that they're weighing right now.
And do you see the recovery being a continual recovery? Or I've heard people talk about potentially a double dip.
We could have the double dip, but the whole theme, Martin, is that in the title of my book is How to Profit from the Coming Inflationary Boom. I believe that all of these stimulus programs, which are totally unprecedented, will result in inflation. And the thing I want to communicate to our audience that in the early stages of an inflationary cycle, businesses thrive, the markets thrive, the stock market, the equity markets, and certainly the commodities, and look at gold is already anticipating an inflationary cycle. And so people, my book is a how-to guide, which is how do you realize profit from this change in this inflationary cycle. And my feeling is that this will continue for 3, 4, 5 years or so, and then morph into, if it gets out of control, into hyperinflation and a typical Ludwig von Mises' crack-up boom. So, you know, Americans have written down $11 to $12 trillion in assets in the past 2 years. My book is aimed at how do you restore some of your wealth. Because when this thing craters again and the nation, as the America's got $20 trillion worth of debt, the next crash is catastrophic, and, both for us and for the rest of the world.
And when you talk about inflation, I mean, you know, most parts of the sort of first, second worlds would probably turn around, and certainly in the UK, in reality, we have deflation. It's obvious. I think in the States, probably it's either deflation or just maybe above zero. What do you define as sort of being hyperinflation? Are we talking like Zimbabwe, or are we talking 40-50%?
Well, the economist definition of it is that when prices of goods and services exceed 25% on an annualized basis, then you make the transition from inflation to hyperinflation. Zimbabwe obviously is an extreme, but all we have to do over here is look at Latin America during the 80s, where inflation rates in Bolivia and in Brazil and Argentina were as high as 10,000% per annum. And Argentina, you know, collapsed in 2001 in a hyperinflationary crack-up boom. So, you know, and look at Iceland. I mean, that was a crack-up boom. You know, everything was going great, and then suddenly one day, boom, it was over. And so there are parallels to it other than Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe. But they can't print this much money or digitally create money out of thin air and not have a ruinous result. And that's what we're experiencing. But, you know, it could be a year, it could be 2 years. Nobody can really determine. But we'll be able to monitor this as we go along. And people who subscribe to my blog will be able to get updates constantly as to my opinion as to where this thing is heading. And at some point in time, we're going to have to get out of the markets, and cash will be king again. It might be in Norwegian krona or Aussie dollars or New Zealand dollars or in British pounds. But at some point in time, we're going to have to get out of the dollar, and that's what I'm advocating now.
And do you think, based on what you see in the past and your sort of, you know, feeling for the future, do you think that we're actually going to experience a time of hyperinflation in most of the developed economies of the world?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm obviously my expertise is here in the United States, and I think the rest of the world will see this happening, and they'll separate themselves. Obviously, we still have a tremendous influence on the rest of the world, but I think one thing that, you know, people talk about deflation, and the biggest threat is deflation. I remind our audience and go back and look at your history, because I'm a historian, and look at your history. All hyperinflations or all severe inflationary trends were born out of times like this, when there was depressions or there was tremendous deflation, and of course it's caused by the creation of all this money out of thin air. And we can look at all of these different histories and find that that's when this condition was gave birth, was in conditions like today where deflation is a major threat.
And I suppose one of the things that I always see here, Buster, is there always, I suppose I see that there's typically a major global conflict that typically always comes around this time as well. Is that something that you also see? You know, you think about, you know, the First World War, the Second World War, even going back slightly further, you know, typically a good war, you know, is typically seen after a period of, you know, financial upheaval, but is also typically can be seen as good because it drives economies.
Well, certainly it was the outgrowth of and the burdens put on Germany after World War One that created hyperinflation in Weimar Germany in 1920, 21, 22, 23 and that was out of the armistice, the settlement of the war. So, you know, each situation is a little different, but it's times of severe deflation give rise to, you know, the politics are going to say we got to solve this problem, and so legislation, and that's what we've done in America. I mean, it's not only one piece of legislation. We've got six different stimulus bills and all of the offshoots and amendments to that and codicils to that. Is it's just totally unprecedented, the amount of money that they're creating out of thin air. It's just, it's people that have been around and been associated with the banking business and so forth for as long as I have, it's just unfathomable to what they've done. And so you have to ask the question, is this all deliberate to crater the U.S. Economy, and then we'll have a massive takeover of the New World Order?
And I suppose one of the questions is, do you believe that we can stop the same things happening economically in the next period of boom, which, you know, typically you always have a bust and then a boom? You know, how are we going to stop people from, you know, loaning money potentially? And that's what most people say sort of precipitated this economic climate, is, you know, that, you know, millions or billions of dollars was potentially lent to, you know, typically Americans who could no way afford the repayments. How are we going to stop that from happening? Or do you just think that the people that are controlling this are just basically not going to let it happen in the same way?
Well, people look to, you know, that there wasn't enough controls or there wasn't enough governance on the banks and so forth. But really what it boils down to, Martin, is there was excessive leverage. You know, Hank Paulson, when he was chairman of Goldman Sachs, went to the SEC, and he convinced them that they could increase their leverage for the banks and the investment banks from 10 to 1 to 40 to 1. Now, that was the, you know, along with the abolishment or the termination of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was, you know, executed into law in 1933-34 during the Depression, but allowing banks to make, you know, unlimited investments and so forth under the revision of Glass-Steagall or the repeal of Glass-Steagall. But it was the leverage that, you know, and of course the creation of the collateralized mortgage obligations and all of the swaps and everything else, allowing Wall Street and the banks and the investment banks to lever up all of their financial statements is what really created this crash.
And one of the things I'm sort of interested in, I know when we last spoke, I think it's fair to say you were probably fairly critical of Alan Greenspan. So what do you think of Ben Bernanke? Has he done a good job?
Well, he's headed off the crisis. He's an expert in the Depression years. You know, in many respects, once they reach that point, what options do they have? And they could have, the other option, of course, is they could have let the chips fall where they may. There wouldn't have been the $800 billion or $700 billion TARP plan. Who knows what might have happened, but here we are a year later, and, you know, these people are going to do, you know, Paulson pointed a gun at America and the rest of the world, basically, and says, if you don't do this, the entire world financial system is going to collapse. So, you know, we as taxpayers and citizens and investors, we had no decision. I mean, we had no part in the decision. They made it. But I think that we'll see a year from now, I think that we'll look back at this period and we'll say it was all overkill. It created too much stimulus in the economy, and of course inflation will then start to really rear its ugly head and get out of control.
Okay, and I'm coming close to time, but there is something, a question I do want to ask is, we've potentially got, you know, major countries across the world have bought, you know, billions of dollars of US debt. You know, and one thing that always interests me is, you know, could you see a case where potentially, you know, the US got into such economic difficulty that maybe, for example, let's just speculate here a little bit, Buster. China decides to call in its debts that it has on the US.
Well, then of course they lose their number one customer. You know, and that's what's kept them in the game. I think that with the purchases of, just like the bond auction this week, I think the purchases of U.S. Treasuries are confined to, you know, 2-year and 3-year, the short-term debt, because as we were talking about on CNBC this morning, Larry Kudlow said, you know, within a short period of time, we're going to see the 10-year bond at 10% interest, a double digit. And it may take a year, 2 years, 3 years, we don't know, but that's where it's headed. And foreign investors and foreign central banks are not going to buy longer or medium-term treasuries. They're going to buy the short-term debt. It's just like California today. California can raise money as long as it's on 60-day or 90-day money. Nobody wants to loan California money on a long-term basis. That's what's going to happen to the government here in the Treasury Department here in the U.S. And but the Chinese, you know, the Chinese are great at playing chess. And if this whole thing goes down, and they've got $2 trillion or near $2 trillion in U.S. Securities and in treasuries, that's the price they pay for having exercised more control over the U.S. Maybe they're the ultimate world power and control entity, but they're patient. And they're going to wait to the opportune moment, and no telling at this point, you know, how that's going to manifest itself. But the Chinese are not going to be without their problems, because their economy is just blowing and going at 8 or 9 or 10% compound growth, and they're going to have the results of capitalism too show up in China, where they're going to have, you know, these boom and bust cycles also.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for the interview. One of the things is, where can our listeners go and find out more about your books and more about your podcast?
Yes, the short way is to go to Lulu, that's my publisher, lulu.com/HLQuist, Q-U-I-S-T. And there you'll see the books and so forth, the greed book and the profit book, but more importantly, how to sign on and subscribe to both my podcast and my blog, and because the blog address, of course, is long, but you can go to it and get it that way, or you know, people can simply Google HL Quist. You got to use my initials, HLQUIST, and that'll lead to Amazon or any place you want to go.
Okay, well, for the benefit of those people who didn't have a pen or a pencil or a piece of paper available, I will make sure that link to your publisher's website certainly goes up on the show notes for this one. I want to thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you again.
Well, I hope that I've given some insight to people in Europe, and maybe some insight to Americans that are listening too. But people are taking notice of my writings and my books, and I'm getting a lot of calls and requests for interviews. So, you know, education's what it's all about. And if we can bring some information to your listeners that they haven't had access to, well, then we've gained. We're all better for it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate it. I know you have become more busy, so thank you very much.
Martin, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.